It's Dear Instructional Designer, episode 26. Hey everyone, and welcome back to Dear Instructional Designer, the show about the instructional design journey. I'm your host, Kristen Anthony. It's season 2 of Dear ID, a season of episodes on the tools, tech, and solutions that IDs use all across the spectrum. Today, I sit down with Joseph Suarez, a really awesome and excellent instructional design veteran of 10 years who I met on the Instructional Design subreddit. Joseph is a man after my own heart, someone who loves the development side of instructional design, but who has also learned a lot about the design side on the job. Joseph shares some really great examples of how his toolbox has enabled him to make some amazing, effective, attention-getting learning experiences, and how he continues to expand his experience by taking on new challenges and exploring new tools. Without further ado, here's my conversation with Joseph. Let's get started. Joseph, to begin with, to introduce yourself to the audience, could you tell us a little bit about your journey so far as an instructional designer?
Sure. Well, it's definitely been an incredible journey. So growing up, I was always exposed to computers because my father ran his own business, setting up local companies with computers back in the 80s, which was, you know, new and exciting thing, computers, and he would get them set up with accounting software and then kind of help them troubleshoot that kind of stuff. So we always had computers in the house, and it was a great opportunity for me to gain what we now call like digital literacy at an early age. I was also heavily into art and music. So, you know, by the time I got into high school, I was trying to figure out ways that I could turn that into some sort of career or find a good major for that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think my first turning point that kind of pushed me towards e-learning originally was in the late 90s, it kind of opened up that you could now create web pages. And it was this big, exciting time to just kind of go out and be an early pioneer in the web, learning how to create things for the web through, you know, we kind of laugh at it now, but sites like GeoCities.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Getting a free email address at Hotmail was a big deal for me, you know. But yeah, just learning how to code that way, just as a hobby, and you know, figuring things out, like how do I add an image to a page and how do I change the color of this thing and move it around? And so I did that a lot. Of course, just got more and more into it. So how do I create the images now? And how do I do this flash animation stuff that everyone's doing now? And so when it came time to pick a major in college, things were still exciting and new, and colleges were really struggling to create curriculums for this type of stuff. But I was fortunate enough to have a groundbreaking program near me from Columbus State Community College. It was interactive multimedia production.
Hmm.
And so it was just that. It was a lot of web design, a lot of graphic creation, Flash, and things I hadn't been exposed to as much, like video editing. We even had like a English class that was focused on writing like news copy, which was really interesting.
Hmm.
Graphic design, color theory, things like that. So when I came out of that program in 2002, I guess I was pretty well versed in a lot of things and built a pretty strong skill set. But I was kind of naive and just thought, okay, now that I've got this piece of paper that says I've been to college for 2 years, someone's going to hand me a job. And it didn't help that it was still after the dot-com crash. So mm-hmm. a lot of places that would have been hiring a year previously weren't, or in some cases even folded up shop. So I kind of struggled for a few years to find any relevant work. Did a lot of temp work, which I can't say I'd recommend it, but at the time it helped me to... It was just a unique experience to work at a lot of different places
mm-hmm.
and view a lot of different work cultures and management styles, most of them negative, but you know, good examples of where not to work in the future and what kind of manager not to work for. But so anyway, that led me, I ended up going back to school to get a 4-year degree. And when I was, you know, working full time at this point and going to school part time. So when I finally finished that in 2007, it was time to really hit the job search hard for, you know, relevant work. And really, I was applying to anything that had Photoshop in the job description. And I just happened to stumble across gaining an interview at a place that was looking for an e-learning developer. Hmm. And they called it, the title was graphic designer, but really they were searching for an e-learning developer. And of course, I got the job, and this was for a computer electronics retail chain, not Best Buy. And they were a team of the manager and two instructional designers prior to me coming on. So they were kind of inundated with all this demand for courses, and they needed someone to help them with that so they could, you know, focus on other things. So I came in, and to be completely honest, I had a moment of buyer's remorse on my first day when they sat me down and had me actually take the training. It was both my first experience actually taking online training in like a corporate environment, mm-hmm. and seeing what it was I was going to be doing. And I always go back to that moment because, you know, it's one of those situations where once you've been in the field for, you know, it's been almost 9 years for me now, or actually almost 10 years, you only have that short window of opportunity to see things with fresh eyes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I remember just looking at that training, and I don't think a lot of training would stand up to the test of time from 10 years ago, but even given that, you know, the audio narration was bad. And of course you had to wait for it to finish until you could click the next button, and things would show up on the screen at kind of awkward times, and just all around bad. And I'm like, oh my gosh, is this what I'm going to be doing now? So that was my first day on the job. Day two, I have to check out this Lectora program that they keep talking about. You know, they keep saying they make all their courses in Lectora, and courses. So I open it up and I'm like, all right, what am I dealing with here? So I, you know, cause I had no previous, I'd never even heard of it. So I hit F1, which is, you know, the accesses the help menu on any decent program. So, and I just start reading, and it's amazing to look back and see that, you know, I went from picking up Lectora for the first time to really creating some awesome stuff about a couple years later. Mm-hmm. And once Trivanis, which is the company that owns Lectora, they caught wind of the stuff we were doing, and they invited us to speak at the 2010 Lectora User Conference. Mm-hmm. So me and my colleague, instructional designer, we went down and just talked about how we put together this kind of like a framework for branching scenarios. And then the following year, I went back and did a solo presentation at the 2011 Lectora User Conference on, I titled it Graphic Design for the Rest of Us, because it's kind of like, definitely at the time, it was something that was lacking from your, you know, standard e-learning course, was mm-hmm, that good visual design sense.
Yeah.
I see a lot more of it now, but I say it's still a need that exists. But so at this point, I'm starting to gain kind of a dangerous combination of confidence and competence. And the economy is kind of picking up, and, you know, I'm kind of outgrowing this entry-level position I was in for 5 years. So mm-hmm. that's when I interviewed for a job at my current organization. And I walked into that interview saying that I was an e-learning developer, but an aspiring instructional designer, because I had started to do some of the, you know, moving from behind the scenes to working with subject matter experts mm-hmm. to make sure their courses looked the way they wanted them to, you know, really basic stuff, but getting there and you know, creating job aids and things like that. So of course I got that job, and pretty early on started to enter into the foray of the instructional design world. So starting off with doing calls and doing needs analysis and asking, you know, those key questions, and then writing my own storyboards that I would then pass off to myself to develop the course. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting to look back and see, you know, count how many different courses I went through the entire Addy process on my own, essentially. Of course, I had the oversight and support of my manager, but you know, it's really interesting because there's not many people that can do both like that, at least that I've come across, mm-hmm. that can do both well. And of course, I would always say that I'm more of an e-learning developer than an instructional designer. But by the time I interviewed for my current role a little over a year ago, you know, I was able to claim that I was this fully rounded learning professional that could, you know, hit every stage of the Addy process. Mm-hmm. And I had a portfolio that could back that up. And last but not least, I definitely have to mention my current team and the work we're doing. It's been great. I work with some creative people and some great minds. And one of the highlights of what we've done is created a mobile performance support app. It's an HTML5, so it's responsive mm-hmm. app, but so in theory it could work on any device, but we target it for iPads, which we have sent out to our 30 sites. And it basically provides just-in-time information in the form of videos, training guides, and job aids for our technicians and operators that are in our labs. And so I got a chance to go down to Austin, Texas at the Focus on Learning conference hosted by the eLearning Guild. This is back in June. Mm-hmm. So me and my colleague, we had a hour-long session where we talked about our app that we call Albert. And we also did the Demo Fest, which is really cool. So this was, I think, maybe like 40 small tables, and each table is set up with a person or two, and you get to go from table to table and talk to the different people about, you know, what they've created and what mm-hmm. their process was. So, you know, of course, actually having a table, I didn't get a chance to go see what everyone else was working on so much, but it was really cool interacting with people and getting that confirmation, that positive feedback from people that we were doing something pretty cool. You know, yeah. I was expecting to at least get that one guy to come up and be like, well, why'd you do it that way? Why didn't, you know, and having that moment where you're like, oh, I guess we should have done it that way, but didn't really get that. I just got a lot of, wow, that's really cool. Oh, you know, we should do something like that. Or mm-hmm. so that type of thing. So really cool stuff. And it's interesting to see how far I've come in just a few short years.
Yeah, that's an awesome journey that you shared with us. Would you say having done sort of the whole gamut, you know, from being the order taker, if you will, to getting to do that actual instructional design role, do you think that it's a good idea for both of those things to be in the same person? Or would you maybe advocate for those being two separate people who maybe work very closely together?
I can't necessarily recommend that they should be two roles, but I definitely would say that each role should at least try aspects of the other role mm-hmm. to, if nothing else, get a better understanding of what the role entails. So from an instructional design position, it would inform better how to create storyboards that I guess have a better impact, to create activities that, you know, maybe are more in line with what a tool like Storyline is capable of, or just have more realistic expectations. Mm-hmm. And from the e-learning developer side, yeah, I just get more of a chance to maybe push back is too strong of a word, but question some things like, so mm-hmm. if our learning objectives are this, what are we really trying to accomplish with this activity? Wouldn't it be better if we set it up like this, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that type of thing. So if you can do both, great. But yeah, as long as you at least get some understanding of each role, I think you're better off.
Okay. Yeah, that's really interesting. So, Joseph, what would you say is sort of in your toolbox, either now or just sort of in general, for designing and developing learning experiences?
Oh, boy. So much. It's just like my background, you know, with the multimedia production thing just makes me a jack of all trades and so many different things, from video to graphic design. Yeah, so I always go back to the visual design of things, that I think if you can get the fundamentals of graphic design down, you know, your color and type and composition, you're able to communicate so much more effectively than I think people really understand. You know, we see the opposite side of that with like death by PowerPoint mm-hmm. and just bad presentations. And we can spot that. But when you can design a well-crafted presentation or even job aid, e-learning course, whatever, it gives so much more credibility to what you're trying to do, which I think opens up so many more channels for transferring skills and knowledge.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Yeah, is that there is a certain expectation that things will look a certain way, and if they don't, then you do risk your credibility as an organization that's trying to teach people stuff. I think that's a really interesting point. So I know that you said you were working with Flash previously, and then you had a job where you did Lectora, and now you're in Storyline. Could you talk a little bit about sort of what that switch to authoring tools looked like and what your learning curve was there? Was it difficult for you to switch? I feel like probably in Flash, you could touch more things. You know, you had more agency over everything. So what did that feel like for you?
Yeah, I definitely agree with that statement. Both Lectora and Flash were pretty powerful. You had the opportunity to do a lot more things. Mm-hmm. It might have taken a little longer. And in Lectora's case, it might have lacked a little polish and been a little clunky, but you could do it. So mm-hmm. So all those tools have their pros and their cons. And
right, right.
I basically discovered Lectora's Storyline is more, you can do a lot of stuff really quick, but your options are limited. So having developed drag and drop activities in Flash, you know, it'd take me a whole day to do it. And then to do that in 10 minutes in Storyline is amazing. Mm-hmm. But then I don't get, you know, as much extra functionality added in as I might if I were develop the thing in Flash. So yeah, I do kind of miss Flash in the sense that, yeah, I don't get that full functionality, but at the same time, it does inform me when I am in developing stuff in Storyline because I know what it's doing behind the scenes. Mm-hmm, mm. And I know when there's these little quirks, I'm like, oh, you know what? That's Flash doing this. Just a quick example. So form fields or text entry fields, mm-hmm. if you know, you want to set it to a certain font, if you don't put anything into that text field to show up on screen initially, it'll default to Times New Roman.
Right.
And that was a bug that, well, I don't know if it's a bug, it's just a thing that Flash used to do. So the trick I would do is to leave a space in that text field if you want to show up blank, and that will preserve your font and color choices. So it's just little things like that, like that I'm always helping my colleagues out with, where my Flash knowledge helps out.
Right. That's awesome. Do you guys explore any of the other tools that are out there, like the Adapt framework or Claro or any of the other tools, or are you sticking mostly with Storyline?
We are actually looking into exploring more tools because now that we have the iPads at each of our site, we have the ability to say, okay, well, what would be the best framework or tools to display stuff on the iPad? And the Adapt framework is definitely one I want to look into. It's always kind of bugged me that the e-learning world has been stuck in this next and previous slide, you know, mindset.
Right. Yeah.
That for whatever reason, scroll bars are just not even considered. Like even Lectora, you know, you have to set a fixed width and height. Mm-hmm. There's no scrolling unless it's by accident, really. And that's always bugged me. It's like when you go to a website, you know, it's no problem to scroll.
Right.
Arguments aside about, you know, what shows up above the fold. People don't have any problem from a usability perspective scrolling down. And even if you're like doing a shopping cart, exercise on Amazon, like you're checking out, you've bought your things, you're checking out, you're still scrolling down, and then you're clicking the next button, right? Mm-hmm. Two aren't mutually exclusive. You can go through a process online and still scroll. Now I forget your original question because I went off on such a rant.
No, you made an excellent point. Is that so? The original question, just to remind all of us, was sort of whether or not you guys are exploring different tools and or whether or not you were staying exclusive to Storyline. But yeah, I mean that's you made a great point. Is that a lot? The big three of our e-learning authoring tools definitely have this PowerPoint slide framework or metaphor. Whereas a tool like Adapt definitely moves more towards a web framework or metaphor where sliding is totally, or scrolling rather, is totally okay. And there's nothing wrong with that. And that's a big difference. And so I'm always happy to hear people exploring that. And I'm glad that you're so thoughtful about that, as well as thoughtful about, hey, now we've got this new, or well, not new exactly, but we've got this other tool now. So let's think about what tools we can use that sort of fit what we're trying to do.
Yeah. And just really quickly, you know, if I could get everyone's ear in the L&D space and tell them one thing, it would be to remind everybody that when we do e-learning or when we create content for the web, it doesn't matter what tool we're using, as long as it publishes to HTML. And that includes, you know, having Flash objects embedded in it. As long as we're publishing to the web like that, we're doing web design. We're doing web development, but we're basically outsourcing a lot of the decision making and hardcore programming to those authoring tools. Mm-hmm. But it's still web development. And I think we could learn a lot if we kind of open the tent up more to include more modern web design practices and people from that world. I think we miss out a lot because we kind of self-brand ourselves as something unique when really we're just web development with a specific objective, which is to basically transfer skills and knowledge.
I like that a lot. I like that a lot. And I think I completely agree with you. I think that that's one of the things that I've been seeing myself as. And that's one of the reasons why I do look a lot at web development, at UX development and all that sort of thing. But what would you say to people who are like, you know, there are already all of these different competencies involved in doing instructional design? Like you talked about, there's this need to do good visual design. Sometimes we have to sort of do technical writing or write good copy. Many of us are also doing video editing and audio editing and all this sort of thing. I mean, what would you say to them about like how to learn all the things, right? Or maybe even sort of try and prevent ourselves from being people who were asked to do everything, right? We're asked to be sort of this unicorn that knows all things about everything. I mean, what would you say would be sort of a way to think about that?
Yeah, there is so much that goes into it to give it that polish and to make it right. And the thing I hear a lot is that when people suggest that instructional designers should learn to code, and for the reasons you were just mentioning, that there's so much that they have to learn already, I don't feel like learning to code is really a necessity, but I would say that understanding code and you know, maybe like the importance of like separation of content from presentation, mm-hmm. and those types of principles are important to learn, and just understanding what code can do and what it can't do is yet another thing that people need to learn. But yeah, I mean, it's not comforting, but at the end of the day, what we do really hits on so many different disciplines. And if we ignore too many of those, I think it stands out and hurts our end users, because mm-hmm. you know, you mentioned usability. If I'm an instructional designer and I'm just going to attempt to do e-learning, and I'm not thinking about, you know, where the end learner is going to think to click next, if I'm not putting myself in their shoes and asking those basic usability questions, then I'm probably not going to make a product that is very effective. Mm-hmm. There's just a lot that goes into this field, And I'm afraid to say that a lot of the vendors that sell these tools sell them as a magical cure-all, mm-hmm. that, you know, you can do all these things. You don't need to learn, you know, no coding or experience like that required. Mm-hmm. We'll do all that for you. And I see that a lot now with claims of, it does all the accessibility for you. All you have to do is check a box.
Right. Like, yeah. Gosh. And that's just so important. That. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even if it does do a lot of stuff, when you check that box, if accessibility is something that's important to you, as it should be, you should still be going behind the scenes and seeing what that checkbox is doing. But yeah, I really don't have a good answer other than there is a lot that goes into it.
Right. Yeah. So the answer is it's tough, and we're all navigating it in the ways that we can.
We shouldn't sugarcoat it. We really
should. Right. Yeah. That's great. So I want to go back actually to this mobile platform. Could you tell us a little bit more about what went into creating that?
Sure. So like I said, I joined my current team a little over a year ago. So I wasn't involved in the original decision-making on where that took place. So I came on board as they were just leaving the mock-up phase and entering the prototype phase.
Okay.
So I got to help influence the design of the app. It's like a tile-based design. And I should mention our main audience. So I'm on the nuclear pharmacy services training team for my organization. Mm-hmm. So our people actually produce radiopharmaceuticals, which are, you know, nuclear drugs that have a half-life that's oftentimes very short, like 90 minutes or something like that. So they have a very short window of opportunity to make these drugs and ship them out to hospitals just in time for the patients to receive the doses. And then oftentimes those are used for like diagnostic purposes. So like PET scans are a big part of what we do. So I mention all that because our people are in the laboratory environment. And once they gown up to go in the lab, they would have to, you know, they don't have a computer in there with them. Mm-hmm. They can't bring their cell phone in there with them. So everything they bring in with them has to be sterile. So by having an iPad in a nice outer box case that they can spray with a solution to keep it sterile, they now have a just-in-time performance support tool with them that they can pull up. So previously, if they were back in the lab and they needed to troubleshoot a piece of equipment, they would have to then degown, go to the computer, you know, maybe pull up an SOP or maybe even, you know, a training, an e-learning they took in the past and go through that again. That might take a while.
Right.
So now they have the opportunity to have that iPad in there with the lab. They don't need to degown and, you know, spend money on those materials. They can pull up the video, and we actually have had great success with user-generated video, where in one case we had an individual SME in the field who was strapping a GoPro to his head and filming himself troubleshooting and doing like weekly and monthly maintenance on machinery. And then we got those videos back and they were a good enough quality that we were basically able to take them as is and put them up on our, we use Vimeo for video streaming hosting. Mm-hmm. And then those feed into the app. So we were able to take those videos, put them up in the app. And, you know, now our people in the field, if they want to do weekly maintenance on a certain piece of equipment, they can pull up those videos and, you know, hear from somebody, one of their peers, walking them through how to do it, just like you or I would pull up a YouTube video on, like, you know, how to change a tire if we were in a bind. Mm-hmm. So again, I've gone off on a tangent. I forget your original question.
But. No, and thank you so much for providing all of that context. So I guess my next question would sort of be, so you came in after the design phase and you were in on the prototyping phase. What sort of tools or tech did you guys use to build this if you can share?
Yeah, so we actually contracted out to a local development firm to do the actual development of the app itself. Mm-hmm. But what they've created for us is, it's almost similar to WordPress in the sense that, you know, there's a front end to it that the end user sees, and there's a back end to it where we can go in and add individual pieces of content and categories and tags. And there's even a section to add HTML code. And that's how we're doing the video embeds and things like that. So it gives us an opportunity to add all those different forms of content in there.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to think what else. So yeah, so we outsource that development side of it.
Okay. Okay. And are you guys looking at analytics of any kind on this to see, you know, how it's doing?
We are. We actually have set up some analytics on, so it's being hosted through the Amazon Web Services,
mm-hmm.
and that allows us to get some analytics. And the development firm that we're working with has just created for us a way that we can track user activity in aggregate, like what everyone's doing, and also at an individual level. Because the way the app works, and for security purposes, is that it's tied to the same account that allows them to access SOPs. It's like their account to the SOP library.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they get it when they're hired, and it's revoked when they're terminated. So they're able to track all their activity based on those credentials. So we can go in and, you know, if, in theory, we could pull up someone who may have been identified as having some performance problems and say, okay, well, it looks like he pulled up the video on troubleshooting the CSU 20 times. So maybe we should talk to his manager about that.
That's really cool. That is really cool. Sort of envious here right now. that's awesome. I love that. And again, thank you for giving us the context first, because it's great that you guys knew so much about that context, about what, like, where users were going to be using this and how best to serve it to them, you know. And it was great that you brought up the fact that, you know, it's time sensitive stuff. So having them derobe and leave and then try and come back and do the thing, is that's bad for business. So you guys came up with a solution that worked with that context. And I think that's an important lesson for all of us.
Right. And just, I'm always amazed at, and I can't take credit for any of this work, but before I joined the team, so much work was done to have a seat at the table with the leadership of our business unit, in particular operations, so that we're able to partner with them and say, you know, there's some gaps here, let us help you with that.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be as simple as, in one example, someone came to us and said, these are the top three things that we're having problems with when people use this piece of equipment. And we could have said, okay, well, actually, I think he came to us and said, can we get a course? And we said, well, we could do a course, but why don't we just put a sticker on the side of the machine that says, you know, don't do these three things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that was it. That was done. And I really like the fact that we were able to do that. And we aren't a training team that is counting widgets, you know, because if we're just counting widgets to validate what we do, you know, we would have said, oh yeah, we'll make a course and we'll crank it out. And, you know, that's another notch in our belt.
Right.
I like that we're able to work alongside our business unit.
Awesome. Awesome stuff. So folks out there listening, this is, you know, it's always tough when you go into the new organization, but if you can get stories like these and figure out how exactly the team you're going to be on is working within the organization, it can be a real eye opener into the type of environment that you're walking into. And so I love that. So Joseph, I'm going to switch course on you just a little bit. I was on your portfolio and I saw the intro to master data management demo, and it was awesome.
Yes.
And I loved it. And I see that you use Storyline to do that.
I did.
And I mean, so what was that like? And were there any other sort of tools or tech involved in creating that?
So much goes into this course. And I was blown away that So that's a course it was the last thing I created on my old team. And then I switched to the different team and they submitted it for an award and it won the category of e-learning. So the IELA, the International E-Learning Association, gave it the top award for the e-learning category. So
nice.
You go to their website, you know, I'm listed at the top. So yeah, I was just blown away by that. So, but yeah, Storyline went into it. And what I really liked about my previous role is it gave me an opportunity to explain really complex topics in simple ways. Cause it was, training around the data and analytics portion of our organization.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many advanced topics, and they're doing so many advanced things in so many different areas. To break down something as complex as master data management is really tough. So I've done like comic book format courses in the past, but I just had this awesome idea for this course that, okay, so what if it's like a detective story and they're trying to solve the case of like the mismatched data? Like there's two spreadsheets that don't align, and the guy, like Law and Order style, has to get to the bottom of it, and he has to go to these different places and, you know, slowly pick up clues. And then there's activities in between that the learner can do to reinforce. And more importantly, the story goes on, but if you want to learn more about all the super complex stuff, there's buttons where you can click to learn more, but you don't necessarily have to do that. As long as you get the basics of what master data is, why it's important, how organizations like big enterprises like ours use it. And then, you know, if you walk away with that, then, you know, you're in much better shape than if you were just presented with all the information at once. So
right.
As far as my process, yeah, I use Storyline. I use the characters in Storyline with the exception of the detective. I added a suit, like a detective suit and hat. And I just kind of, and they're just transparent pings that I added on top of him whenever I put him on the screen.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, I was able to do a lot of fun stuff with it. And it definitely has that graphic novel feel to it. I was able to do some really cool scenes in it that I'm proud of. By far, my favorite is when the detective has to go down and interview Denny, the database admin, I think his name is. And he's down in the data warehouse district or something like that. It's just, I had lots of fun with it, and it's got humor in it. And, you know, I just threw it out there as an idea. And I was really surprised when my manager told me to run with it. And then the next hurdle was to make sure the SMEs and, you know, stakeholders were on board with it. And it only took a little bit of convincing, but they were on board too. And yeah, it's just gotten it's been well received.
Yeah. And that was sort of going to be my next question, is that I know sometimes people are concerned that they might get pushback for trying to do something fun. Like, so this course, it has illustrated characters instead of more photorealistic characters, and it has humor, and it's in the graphic novel format, and it's sort of, you know, it's a detective story, and instead of, you know, a more serious, this is master data management. So, I mean, so you were able to convince people that it's okay to do these things and to have a little fun. Like, how did you do that?
How did I build the justification for doing that?
How did you convince them that it was okay to have a little humor, to, you know, use something that was maybe cartoony? And I don't know if you guys sort of previously had more photorealistic things, but I know that in a lot of my organizations, something with cartoons probably would have been pushed back against. So how would you defend that?
Well, first and foremost, I think that, you know, like I said, I wanted to do that comic book format many times in the past, but I had to wait for the perfect opportunity, right? Mm-hmm. I had to have a strong opportunity to tell a good story, and that came along for this course. And I think those people that were a little hesitant once they started to go through the story, they could see the benefit of telling it in that format.
Mm-hmm. So did you prototype it for your SMEs to look at, or did you just do storyboards?
I actually did do a storyboard. I'm trying to remember if I hand sketched it or just kind of did something really quick in PowerPoint. But I do remember originally I actually had a Scooby-Doo ending to it where they pull off the mask and it's actually somebody else. I don't remember how that was even going to work, but I just threw that in there and my manager said, yeah, let's run with it. And as I started to actually flesh out the real story, that, like, you know, what happens in writing, you kind of kill your darlings and, mm-hmm. You know, go with what works. So yeah, to be honest, I'm surprised I got away with it, but yeah, you know, I did have to build some justification for it. And I really think that it just fit the right need and that's why it succeeded.
Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. So it fit a need with the story that you were trying to tell. And that was probably the biggest thing to help you justify that. So that's a good lesson for us to think about.
Yeah. And the same goes for if, you know, you wanted to build a game in a course, you know, mm-hmm. you shouldn't walk into it saying, all right, well, the next course I build, I'm going to put a game in there.
It's, right.
You have the content has to have a need for a game. You can't force it.
Right. Yeah. Really good advice. So with your current tool set, would you say that there were sort of any gaps, any things that you find that you can't do that you want to do? And how, if at all, how do you shore up those gaps or those weaknesses?
At this point, because I've tried so many different things and I've gone down the realm of the instructional design side of things, mm-hmm. my coding skills are getting pretty rusty, which I'm glad we, you know, ended up contracting out to build the app because, mm-hmm. you know, I could have accomplished a lot of that, but to have it all on me would have been, yeah, that would have been a nightmare because I'm pretty rusty on that. You know, to be honest, storylines kind of spoiled me in that, you know, like we were talking about, it can do so many of the things that used to take me so long to do in Flash that I kind of, it's almost like a GPS in the car, right? You used to have to look at maps and have this, you know, concrete knowledge of where we're going. And now we just kind of listen to this disembodied voice tell us when to turn and things like that. So it's a little bit similar in storyline. I'm just kind of like, yeah, just a few triggers here and boom, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
So my coding skills are getting a little lax. Before I joined my current team, I would have said video production. I've been able to do a fair amount of video editing, but actually going out on like location and filming and getting the lighting right and all those things that have to come together to get a good video shoot.
Mm-hmm.
But I've actually had a lot of opportunities to do that. So just previously this year, I got to go out to our Indianapolis location and shoot a video there. And for the first time I got to try like a dual camera setup and I had like a full shot list and, you know, we're acting things out. And I was thinking about like continuity editing and all these things that I hadn't done previously. So maybe it's just me, but you know, I always get excited to try new things.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I do have a gap, it's like, all right, let's focus on that. Let's see what I can do.
Right.
And have a good understanding that, you know, it's not going to be great right away. You know, it's going to take me a while to get it to a point where I'm happy with it.
Mm-hmm.
But the good thing about the e-learning development world, and I say this kindly, but the bar is set kind of low. So the expectations for quality aren't as high as, say, maybe, you know, Hollywood productions or something where things are more upscale. So you can get away with a lot more and experiment with a lot more things as you're learning.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And I think it's great that you use your people and your facilities in your video and in your stock. So I know that not everybody can do that. So, I mean, would you say that that's sort of true with all the things that you create, that you guys use your people, your locations in the stock photography or the video and all that sort of stuff when you're creating learning assets?
Largely, especially with me joining the team, we now have such a diverse range of skills that we're able to do so much. But we also know our limits. So if we want to produce a really good video, we'll still contract out for that. With, you know, there's some local production groups that we work with to get that kind of stuff done. And I think I've worked with my manager to set up good expectations around what I'm capable of doing on my own versus, you know, when it would be a good time to call in the big guns, so to speak.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we for stock stuff, our organization has an image library that we can pull from that has some pretty good quality stuff. And then our team, every time we go to a location, especially if it's a new location, I'll just wander around and take shots of things. Cause you know, in the training world, in a highly regulated environment, you never know when you're going to need a picture of, you know, the fire alarm on the wall or So I just go around taking pictures of everything. And it actually paid off because my colleague was like, "Hey, you went to the Indianapolis facility. Did you happen to take a picture of the tornado shelter sign?" And I'm like, "I sure did." So we built, in addition to the organization's image library, we kind of have our own that I've been able to put together.
Awesome. So yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question. How do you guys share that with each other? I wrote a blog post about sort of creating a visual language and how we have basically the only tool that we use regularly is Box. So I just went on Box because, you know, you don't want to introduce some other tool that people aren't going to use. And so I tagged all of the assets that I've been collecting. So how do you guys share those with each other? So, you know, if somebody new were to come on, how would they know, you know, A, how to get to your image library, and B, how to find sort of the thing that they're looking for?
We actually use Box as well.
Okay.
And we're very fortunate that it's now a company approved cloud sharing platform, because previously, if I wanted to create something like that and play within the rules, I would have had to put that all up on SharePoint, which would have been less than ideal. So I'm glad that we now have the company approved box.com account that's tied to our single sign-on and all that. So I actually use a tool called Box Sync, which functions very similar to Dropbox, if you're familiar with it, where you have your folder on your computer and then that syncs to the cloud. So I store our team's entire image library of supplementary content on my computer locally, and then that syncs to the cloud. And being like the primary multimedia guy, I'm able to pull from that without having to go over a network connection. And then if anyone else needs that stuff, I've shared it on Box so they can go in online or however they use Box and pull different assets down for their projects. But by having it locally, it allows me to then point something like Adobe Premiere directly to that folder. And I don't have to mess around with, you know, creating new, you know, directories of assets or anything. So
yeah. Do you find that folks are able to easily sort of, you know, if somebody's looking for that photo of the fire alarm or the tornado shelter sign, are they easily able to find it in this folder of assets? Like, do they just sort of search? Are you guys tagging them? Do you have a naming system that you use?
I started a naming convention and I think it's pretty ideal, but I've only introduced the library to the team, you know, in like the past 6 months or so, and I haven't heard much feedback. But yeah, I have a naming convention where so we have like a few different areas of the business that we support. So it's like the first thing on the file name is which area of the business is that. The second one is something like what are we looking at? Like, what is the environment? So is this a manufacturing facility? Is this, the back offices or whatever? You know, what's the focal point of the image? different names of the pieces of equipment, an action that someone's doing in the image. And then because we're always looking for photos of people, I'll tag that as like, I think I put like the word tech, because, you know, we refer to them as technicians. So, so when I'm searching the folder, all I have to do is in Windows File Explorer, whatever it's called, just go to the search bar and write tech or write manufacturer, and all those relevant images will pull up instantly.
Okay, nice.
Because I think, I don't know if you can even do tagging on Box, and if you could, it might be a little cumbersome. So to get all that instantly and just like a quick search, you know, I think the file name is enough.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I was wondering about that. You can tag on Box. That's what I've been doing. And you can search via tags. You do have to, like, it's an extra click that you have to do. But yeah, I'm glad to hear about the naming conventions. I think that's always something that I'm interested in, is sort of when we're creating systems of sharing, how we can do that the most effectively. So that's really great insight there. And so, Joseph, last but not least, tell us where people can catch up with you.
So josephsuarez.com is my website, where I point to the different places where I exist online, including Twitter, where my handle is @Joseph_Suarez. It's a great place if you want to have a conversation. That's a great place to go. But I know Twitter's not for everybody. So of course, I'm also on LinkedIn and places like that. But if you go to my website, there are plenty of opportunities to and ways to contact me and also view my portfolio.
All right. Awesome. Thank you so much, Joseph.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Let me just say that I love that Joseph really laid it on the line. Similar to what EJ LeBlanc talked about with us, Joseph reminds us that lifelong learning in both the development and the design side of our industry is part and parcel with the work that we do. It's hard and it's time consuming, and it is so, so worth it. I also love that he talked about how we, as instructional designers who create content for the web, are all really web developers. It's an amazing way of looking at it. And what that means to me is that we have a responsibility to educate ourselves in the solutions of web development so that we can take what works and create even more effective experiences. Thank you so much for listening, folks. You'll want to check out Joseph's portfolio. I loved his stuff. I'll have a link to that in the show notes. Also, please give Joseph a shout out on Twitter. He's @Joseph_Suarez. And as always, you can reach out to me. I'm @AnthChris. Or you can shoot me an email at Kristen@DearInstructionalDesigner.com. I'll talk with you again soon. Take care.